Well, we'll go breezing on into 1916 then. In April.
Of course, that was one of the very big things that we did with this, I think, this woman voters affair. And having that booth and getting that petition presented with such enormous number of people.
What do you think? How do you rate what that accomplished?
Well, I think it accomplished everything we wanted. It was one of the big outstanding things, I think, that we did. It's the first convention ever held by women voters, you see.
Yeah.
And getting them as far as we could get them lined up for this policy of opposing the party in power as long as it continued to oppose us. And then getting it dramatized by going across the country so the whole country would know about it, I think was very effective and very useful.
Well, you followed that up in April of 1916 with that big meeting.
That's the one in Chicago.
Not yet, I don't believe. This was a conference in April 8th and 9th in Washington that included members of the advisory committee, of an advisory committee, representing 36 unenfranchised states. And CU was ready to undertake its most pretentious election campaign, and Alice Paul called for, quote, an independent political party. And there was a big procession connected with all of this gathering of women, too. I'm sure you never missed a chance to have a procession.
Well, that's when we decided to call it, to have what we call the National Women's Party, is that it?
Yeah, I think so. And then you held your big gathering of the
in Chicago
but just see, before the other conventions.
Yes, it was made up only of women who could vote.
Yeah.
And we elected Mr. Ann Martin president.
And you had a big train that went from the east to the west to invite everybody around the end of April. It went all around the suffrage states.
Well, we had three special trains. One was the suffrage special, we called it.
Mm-hmm.
They went all around the country, and then we followed it later by one called the prison special, where all the people who went were ex-prisoners.
That was not in this campaign, though. That was later.
Later, yes, yeah. That's right. But you see, at that meeting in Chicago, we voted to carry this campaign in the coming election into all the states where women were voting. Just concentrate on that.
Like you had done in 1914?
Only we did on a much bigger scale.
It's bigger because you had more states or because you used more women?
No, because it was much bigger because we'd just grown stronger.
Yeah.
We had more women we could send out to campaign.
Yeah.
We had this. We started off with this big convention in Chicago. And Mrs. Belmont, I remember, got up and pledged, I think it was $50,000, in the suffragists will tell what it was, to defeat every Democrat. And she didn't actually give the money later on. I don't know what happened to her.
Oh.
But she often was, we got to know her through the years. She was very often full of enthusiasm, said, I'll pay for this. You know, there are lots of people who do that.
Yeah.
And then when the time comes, they think, well, I guess they'd rather not. So she didn't give us anything like $50,000. But I think, anyway, she announced it, got up and announced it at this big, great big meeting in some Blackstone Theater do you have or something
yes,
like that?
Yes, that's right.
In Chicago. And that's one where we had all these men come from the different parties to say what they would do.
Oh, yes. Now tell about that.
It's all there in the suffrage.
You had the men coming to you. Well, all the suffrage says is that representatives from each party did come and did try to woo you to their cause and to their party.
And I remember particularly Dudley Field Malone, who came for the Democrats, first time we'd ever met him. And he was, of course, an eloquent speaker. And he became absolutely furious. Furious that we would dream of opposing the Democrats. And he wasn't able to give any real satisfactory pledge that they would help us. But I think we had everybody come, every party. And at that time, I think the Roosevelt Party, which had dwindled to a very little one, gave us an endorsement. and the Prohibition Party and the Socialist Party.
Yes, I do. I have here that even before this happened, I think about May, Teddy Roosevelt announced in favor of
Yes, but then at this time his party did.
His party. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe you would know what brought Roosevelt around, or who brought him around.
Roosevelt?
Teddy Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm. What date are you on now?
Well, this was just before you met in Chicago. This was in May, and you met in Chicago in June for your first national convention.
There was a suffrage meeting held in New York, not by us. I don't know who, probably by Mr. Blatcher's Society, but some suffrage meeting. And I went up to it, and just to be present. And Mr. Roosevelt was supposed to be the principal speaker. And I remember going with Mrs. Lawrence Lewis, our national treasurer, after the meeting was over, around up to the platform to thank Mr. Roosevelt for the wonderful speech he'd made for suffrage. Now, perhaps that's the time you have that he came out.
Oh, maybe.
But he did. But then I remember that we always regarded him as an ally. Always. And I think that this meeting out in Chicago, when his party had, you know, first, he had before that a convention. He had two conventions. The first one when they formed this Bull Moose, and I think that was the one when he ran against them.
Well,
against Wilson, and Wilson got in.
Wilson, yeah.
Because there were so many candidates, Wilson got in. Mm-hmm. Because the Republicans were divided between Roosevelt and whoever the other candidate was.
Taft.
I guess so. Mm-hmm. So then, he wasn't deeply interested, but we regarded him as a friend. And when Hughes was finally nominated for the Republicans at that convention, you know, in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
We tried, of course, to get every candidate to come out. And just as we tried this year to get McGovern and Nixon, still doing the same old thing. Well, we couldn't get Hughes. And so one night, Miss Alice Carpenter, who was one of the leading Republican women in New York and a personal friend of Roosevelt, and whom I'd asked to try to get Roosevelt to use his influence with Hughes. We were getting everybody to go to Hughes and say, don't be such a fool, do come out with this measure, and so on. And so Miss Carpenter said, I think that we'd better go out and see Mr. Roosevelt, and said, I know him, and I know he'll make an appointment and see me, and if you'll come along with me, because you perhaps know more about what's going on. So I said I would. So we went out together to Oyster Bay and made an appointment to see him. I remember this so vividly. So when we went in, he was all alone waiting for us, and in a sort of library, I guess it was. And he said, well, now, the great trouble is in politics that people don't seem ever to quite master this thought, that you not only have to be right, but you have to be right in time. And he said, Hughes is undoubtedly someday going to come out for this measure. And he said, I don't think I can get him to come out now. He's has to consider so much and take so long. He just hasn't mastered the idea that if he's to be president, he thinks this is right, apparently, that he must be right in time and let the world know. So he said, I don't know that I can do one single thing with him, but of course I think you're on the right track and so on. And so then Mr. Hughes started on his campaign across the country. We'd sent quite a good many delegations to Hughes himself, and he was always saying this would require quite a lot of thought, and the idea of the state referendums and everything had to be carefully weighed and so on. So nobody had been able to get him to say anything. So he started on his campaign, and he first spoke in Wyoming, the first suffrage state, and he wouldn't commit himself in any way on the suffrage amendment. And then he went on through the suffrage states, down to California and so on, never committing himself at all on the suffrage amendment, in spite of constant requests from him, sent to him. So when he got back to New York, where they did not have the vote, then in a great speech that he made, his final speech, he came out for the suffrage amendment. It was just a perfect example of doing what Roosevelt said he would do.
Yeah.
To retimed himself to be for it in all those suffrage states, he would want so much more support.
Mm-hmm.
And if he'd kept silent, if he had to keep silent in New York, where it was not a popular measure at that time, he would have been much wiser. So he finally did come out.
Well, the Woman's Party organization had a hearing also before the resolutions committee of each party.
Yes,
To try to get it on the party platform.
Yes.
Now, can you tell anything about that, what went on in those hearings?
Yes, I've already, I think, told you about that. It's from 1916. And when you were telling me that the National American had rescinded its support of the Southworth Palmer, and I said it's hard for me to believe that they did that in 1915, because I can remember the opposition, tremendous opposition to us, when we asked for the federal suffrage amendment at this hearing in Chicago. I told you all that before.
Oh, what, would you mind repeating it
yes.
now?
Yes. Remember anything about what I told you?
Mm-mm.
Don't you remember what I told you?
Well, I remember some, but I want you to tell it to me as though I don't, so I can get it all down.
All right. Well, I said I'd have to look this up and see about that rescinding of this support of the suffrage. Southworth Palmer, because when we went in 1916 to Chicago, there seemed to be the greatest schism in there between the people who were working for the Southworth Palmer and the people working for the Susan B. Anthony Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And then to show you how there was, I said that we wanted to get, first of all, a headquarters to work from. And I appointed a Miss Sarah, and asked Miss Flatman to go off and find the headquarters for us. And that time the different stores were giving their show windows to different groups of women, helping, I suppose, helping them, they think, thought in advertising. And so Miss Flatman secured a very good location, a shop in a very good location with big show windows, and we would have that for our headquarters throughout this campaign with the Republican and Democratic and all the other candidates. Are you listening to me?
Yes, I am.
So then, in a short time, we received word from the owners of this apartment, this hotel, I mean this business house, had the show windows, that they learned that we were not a group in good standing and so on,
yeah.
And that they would withdraw. They were withdrawing their offer of the headquarters. So then we had to go forth and get another, which we did. But the chairman of the whole group out there that were getting up a parade to the streets of Chicago asked us to come in and join with them and said they would like very much to have us do so, because we'd been getting up a lot of things with lots of people and they thought we could help them.
Mm-hmm.
So we said we'd be delighted to, and I went around to see her and told her what we always carried in our processions was, we demand an amendment to the United States Constitution enfranchising women. You remember I told you all this. And she said, oh, well, then we won't allow that. We won't allow you to come in our procession, because we couldn't possibly put such a banner as that up. We're just saying we believe in suffrage, and we're asking the parties to come out for suffrage for women. And so then we didn't go, and they went alone. It was a day of terrible storms. So they came, we went in, separately, to the platform committee. It's two different groups with two different amendments.
Oh.
And I'm not sure exactly what they did get. They may have got an expression of approval of suffrage, I guess maybe they did by that time, but they did not get anything about, and we did not get anything for the suffrage amendment. But we were two groups, they were refusing letters to walk with them if we mentioned this enfranchisement of women by a federal suffrage amendment. So it seems to me it's very hard to understand how they could nationally be taking a stand against any mention of this subject, and they didn't mention it at all in their presentation to the committees.
Mm-hmm.
But we did. But, and I think we got the only socialist prohibition and the third party, Roosevelt's party, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember when later on in Congress, when Mrs. this is just an aside, when Mrs. St. George was the before Mrs. St. George became our leader for the Equal Rights Amendment. The senator who had been, the congressman who had been leading the fight for us, died or was defeated. He was no longer there. So we had to get a new leader. And so I remember going to see Congressman Robeson of Kentucky, Republican, and asking him if he would become our chief sponsor. And I remember his saying to me, "Well, you perhaps don't remember me, but I remember you very well. I was on that platform committee in Chicago in 1916, and I remember you all coming in wet and bedraggled and wanting to have the suffrage amendment before Congress, approved by our platform committee. And we didn't approve it, but he said, I made a very deep impression on me, and I am personally supporting it, and I will be glad to be your chief sponsor. Mm-hmm. So I remember these very, very well, that hearing that we had there, which again was the two groups of women still asking for the Shackford-Palmer, as far as I can see, and asking for the full amendment.
Well, at least suffrage did become a part of the platform in each of the major parties.
Yes, just general suffrage, but not the federal suffrage amendment.
I think that was the first time that any kind of suffrage had been mentioned. But I wondered if it was more the National Association's idea. I copied down what the Resolutions Committee of the Democrats said. Let's see, the Democrats recommended the extension of the franchise to the women of the country by the states upon the same terms as men.
Yes, that's the state referendum.
And the Republicans said each state is to settle this question for itself.
You see, that was the position that the National American was taking.
Yeah.
So, after all those years of Miss Anthony going to these conventions and so on and working all by herself, you see, it made me feel very sad to think that the women themselves would consent to work against themselves. But they did. Well, now what's the next question?
Oh, well, I have that Wilson is still standing on states' rights, and
yes, he was.
And he spoke to the Atlantic City Convention of NAWSA I think that was sometime in the summer when he spoke to them. And I wondered if this made hearts sink in the National Woman's Party.
Well, that was his position. There was not anything unusual about that.
Okay.
It wasn't very much of an event. That's what he always said.
Okay. Then on August 10th, 11th, and 12th...
Of course, you see, the thing that was bad about it all was that a separate organization that had had the tradition of working for many, many years before we were even born for this federal suffrage amendment, that they would have at their national convention an address by a person who said he was against it.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave support to our not getting it.
Yeah. And just further divided everything, I guess, everybody. Then, at any rate, it looks like you had a planning conference at Colorado Springs. And this was August 10th, 11th, 12th. And again, you had...
What year was that?
That's in the same campaign.
1916?
Mm-hmm, and that's in August. And you had representatives of the Republican and Democratic parties come to plead with you there. And that's where you planned your big campaign and the organizers' work and so forth.
No, it wasn't. No. We planned all that up in Chicago.
Oh, well.
When
it
was
says that there you were going to plan the protest campaign, I guess, against the Democrats.
Well, maybe a protest campaign for Colorado. We planned the protest campaign against the Democrats up in Chicago when we elected Ann Martin to be the president of the National Woman's Party, made up only of women from the suffrage states.
Except that was before you definitely had the word that the Democrats were not going to include it in their platform that year.
What's that?
You met before the Democrats met in Chicago in June. So you didn't really know yet that for sure that the Democrats were going to exclude the amendment from their platform. You didn't know that until after your convention in Chicago, right?
Well, I wouldn't say that. We knew when we went out there, the person who came to speak for the Democrats, I told you how Dudley Field Malone, who afterwards married Ira Stevens, stood there and argued on that platform, I remember. Till finally the people who owned the hotel or the hall came and put down the curtain to send him home. He was in such a towering rage that we were, when Miss Belmont got up and pledged $50,000 to defeat the Democrats, there was never any doubt in our minds that up to that moment they were opposing us. And then couldn't say anything that they were going to change their policy was the reason he was so angry. I don't see why what we would do out in, well, I remember very well that meeting out in Colorado, but it was totally different from what you say.
Oh. Maybe it was just for Colorado then.
Was the meeting when, I remember when I was there at that meeting, and what date was it? Will you tell me again?
August 10th to 12th.
I remember that Hazel Hunkins, and I've told you about her over in Europe, I think, and how I went up with her tomorrow to see Jeanette Rankin,
girl
from Montana, to try to get Jeanette Rankin to vote against war, just unofficially from ourselves. Well, we'd never seen her, but she came down from Montana, and we could probably find all this out about in the Kostenstein book, because Miss Kostenstein had gone out and our organizer to Montana.
Oh.
And in that campaign. And she had gotten this Hazel Hunkins interested. So when we had our meeting down in Colorado Springs, Hazel came down, first time we ever met her, and wanted to throw in her life work with us, which she did. She went on with us down to Washington and remained one of our workers until suffrage was won, and went to prison with us. We have some pictures of her heading the suffrage procession. She was going out to the White House to picket. She's a very lovely girl. And I don't remember it being as anything but just one of the organizing meetings that we had there. I certainly wasn't going to plan our policy, because our policy had been planned and we'd elected a committee headed by Miss Martin to carry it out.
Yes, yes. That much had been done, I know. Well, and in the big campaign, everybody went out and pitched in the suffrage states. But could you give any picture of how this was organized and how you...
Yes, it was all organized from Chicago, and I was there and stayed through the whole campaign organizing it. I didn't go into any of the states except in Aguindo, go down to Colorado for that meeting. But, for instance, in Chicago, we had a big banner across the street, vote against the Democratic Party and so on. I don't know what exactly it said, but that was its idea. Because they were against the enfranchisement of women was the idea. And we did it, and all the states had these great banners because we had so little time and little money, and one great banner gave your message pretty well to each big city. And we had somebody in every one of these separate states. We usually sent two or three together. And they did just the ordinary things you always do. For instance, in Chicago, I remember that a person named Matilda Hall Gardner, who came from Chicago, came out to help us. her husband was the NEA representative, and you know what the NEA is? National Enterprise, wasn't it?
Oh.
A great newspaper. Great
oh, news. Yes. The newspaper organization.
Yes.
Okay.
NEA. Well, her husband was the NEA, head of the NEA Bureau in Washington. And she came to Chicago to help because she'd grown up in Chicago and knew a great many people there. So she took over, I remember, the question of getting up parlor meetings. And she had little parlor meetings every day, practically, to which we would send somebody to speak, trying to turn votes in that little district. You just said, by anybody conducts a campaign.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the way the Republicans did it, the Democrats did it, only they did it at a bigger and vaster scale than we were able to do.
Yeah.
Then we took deputations.
To candidates.
I don't know whether any candidates came, but if they did, we would take deputations to them.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a great many street meetings in Chicago. We just tried to put the question on the map and turn as many women as we could. I remember one woman, you perhaps know who she is and know her. Oh, she died again 2 or 3 years ago. Mrs. Avery Coonley, did you ever know her?
No. Avery?
Avery Coonley. She and her sister were very wealthy women who inherited quite a fortune from their father, who came from Michigan. And they were very public-spirited. They, for instance, they gave the alumni house at Vassar, gave the whole building, and they did great many things. And her husband was in charge of the information service for the Christian Science Church. She was a very devout Christian Scientist. And somehow or other, Elsie Hill had gotten to know her. I don't remember how. Elsie Hill was out there in Chicago with me. And just speaking all the time, because she was a very good speaker, just never ended speaking. Trying to change votes, as many votes as we could. And we had a very prominent woman as our state chairman out there in Chicago. And Mrs. Julius Rosenwald, did you ever hear of
that? Oh, yes.
Went on our board out there. And I remember that simplified everything for us, because anything we would want almost, by using Mrs. Rosenwald's name, we made it much easier for us to get. And for instance, we didn't have to establish a big bank account or anything, because they knew Mrs. Rosenwald was on our board. It helped us a great deal. So we got very influential women out there in Chicago, I think, to help. But among others, Elsie Hill got to know Mrs. Avery Coonley, who was interested in progressive education and had started some kind of a school out there which she financed. And Elsie, I guess, was interested in that and got to know her that way. Or probably she got to know her through Vassar, because they were both Vassar graduates. So she took me one day out to see Mrs. Coonley, and we thought she'd have a big circle, and if we would get these prominent women, they would, each one would have a big circle, and it might be an easier way to get votes for what we wanted. And so I remember asking her if she wouldn't not vote for Wilson and not vote for any Democrat. And she said she'd have to think about this and so on. But anyway, from that interview, she became a warm friend and continued until her death. So I went out after the campaign was over, and Wilson had been reelected, of course. And that's when we had all this campaign to get Hughes and didn't succeed. But, and so I went to see her to ask her for money then. And I remember she gave him, I think about $750 or something. And she said, Now I want you to go to see my sister, Mrs. Elon Hooker, because we try to make our gifts together. And if she knows I've given to the Woman's Party, she will give to the Woman's Party, and probably the same amount. And so I said, well, now, how did you vote? And she said, I voted just as you asked me to vote. I voted for the prohibition ticket all the way down the line. So we knew we were turning a great many votes. And I suppose you were too young to know anything about the campaign when it came to California.
Yes, I've just read about it.
Well, I think that's all I know about it.
Something kind of intrigued me, and I don't know whether you can throw any light on this or not, but according to the suffragist, you had a very good kind of reporting system set up so that you were able to warn certain Republicans when you felt that they were going to lose in certain districts. And in the West. And I think the suffragist intimates that you kind of established a reputation for knowing what the political winds were in each district around the West.
Well, of course we did. We had to.
That you had a better system operating than either political party did.
Well, I don't know about that. But we always had a group, in every state, a group of women who kept us informed of what the situation was. Of course, you see, most of these men in the suffrage states were all, practically was unanimous among them to support the federal suffrage amendment.
Yes.
So we were not out, we were out to try to defeat all Democrats because they had caucus and were in power and could do it and wouldn't do it. But we were not out, of course, to elect the Republicans. We didn't go out to do that. Go out to do any party. We didn't care whether they voted like Mrs. Kuhlman, whether they voted prohibition, socialist, or Republican, whatever they wanted to vote.
Yeah.
I think it was, I've always thought it was one of the most powerful instruments that we could find and that we did use to change the Democratic Party and change President Wilson. Because, of course, you know, it wasn't so long after that that he did change.
Yes, and did Vance McCormick was the man who was head of the Democratic Party, chairman of the Democratic Party for that campaign. And I guess after the campaign was over, he made the statement that by the next election in 1918 that the weak places in the Democratic Party must be patched up. And one of the weak places, he said, was that meant suffrage and doing something about suffrage before then. Do you remember that?
No, but I'm glad to know it.
That he said it. Okay. In your own evaluation, did you feel that you were more successful in your 1916 efforts than you had been in your 1914 efforts?
Well, of course, we did on a much bigger scale. We ourselves become much larger, stronger. We had more women to go out to those different states. We tried to send somebody, and I guess we did send somebody from Washington to every state. Because those people who went in with nothing to do but to defeat the Democrats could accomplish more than getting some local committee that were doing like myself, having storm windows put on and being diverted by everything else.
Yeah. Oh, I see. So it really worked better if you sent someone out into the state.
That's the reason we always did.
Oh, yeah. Well, I should think that you also stood the chance of a local person getting diverted, too, into another campaign that was going on at that same...
But anyway, by sending somebody out, and she had the one task of keeping, if there wasn't a good local committee, building it up,
mm-hmm.
and... guided them. It was, the whole thing was, I think, worked very well.